I'm Brett Baer, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Thursday, May 31st, 2018. I'm Chris Foster. From a missed opportunity to new hope for talks with North Korea.
Kim Jong-un and the president both want and need this summit for their own political and geopolitical purposes.
I'm Jessica Rosenthal. Plug in and take off. We get behind the wheel to look at the good and the bad about today's electric cars.
You're maintaining control, but you're allowing this to assist you. So it's solely a driver assistance feature.
I'm Judge Andrew Napolitano, and I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
Top North Korean officials in New York City to meet with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo about potential talks between President Trump and Kim Jong-un. The president last week canceled those talks.
Well, many things can happen, and a great opportunity lies ahead, potentially. I believe that this is a tremendous setback for North Korea and, indeed, a setback for the world.
The response to the cancellation was warmer than other recent statements from the North Korean government, and now preparations for the talks in Singapore have ramped up, with teams talking about logistics and policy goals, and now this high-level meeting in New York with the Secretary of State.
It's a very good sign.
Bill Richardson was ambassador to the United Nations and energy secretary during the Clinton administration and then governor of New Mexico. He's been to North Korea several times and negotiated hostage releases.
This is a major player, a heavyweight in North Korean government. In politics. He's essentially Kim Jong-un's right-hand man, nuclear negotiator, intelligence chief, somebody that survived going from Kim Jong-un's father now to Kim Jong-un. He's been a nuclear negotiator in the past. You know, he's equivalent to the number two person in North Korea. So the fact that he is here is, I think, a very good sign for the summit, and maybe even a good sign that a good agreement can come forth.
What did you think when President Trump canceled the meeting? Do you think it was just negotiation, or do you think he actually had intention to walk away?
I disapproved of what he did. I'm a traditional diplomat. I don't like the tweeting, the acting impulsively, speaking with too many messages. But I think what has helped is the fact that Kim Jong-un and the president both want and need this summit for their own political and geopolitical purposes. Kim Jong-un, because maybe he feels he's ready to bring North Korea into the international community. And I think the president, you know, this is a potentially legacy achievement. And also, he wants to kind of shift the conversation away from his domestic problems.
You talked about too many messengers. Now, some members of the administration, John Bolton, then Vice President Pence, have referred to this Libya model for North Korea, presumably referring to immediate denuclearization and not like a gradual ramp down. They left out the part where Muammar Gaddafi was eventually overthrown and mutilated in the streets. So the North Koreans didn't take too kindly to that. Was that a mistake to use that terminology, do you think?
That was a mistake. I think one of the reasons that I think we've had a very uncertain situation is the administration, and I've praised the president for taking the summit meeting with Kim Jong-un. I think it was wise and risky, but the right thing to do. But he's got too many messengers. There should be one messenger. It should be the Secretary of State who has dealt with the North Koreans directly, with Kim Jong-un. And I think the vice president's comment and the national security advisor's comment about the Libya model, which resulted in the death of Gaddafi, rattled Kim Jong-un. And it was a bad reference. They should just let Pompeo run the show, have his meeting with the spy chief, and lead the president. Too many cooks in the oven, but hopefully this will be fixed. But I wonder, with this administration and their mixed messages.
How much of the work of a summit like this is done before the summit? I mean, does President Trump and Kim, are they just kind of there for pictures and handshakes and signing off on what's already agreed to, or is there substantive work that they can get done, the two of them?
Usually in summits, a lot of the work is done by aides, Secretary of State, defense chiefs, National Security Council, State Department, diplomats before the summit. And the leaders basically ratify what their aides have done. This is a traditional summit. Now, with this summit, with these two leaders, with President Trump, you know, shooting from the hip, and Kim Jong-un being almost a total dictator and having his own style, this is why you want to pre-cook a lot of the good stuff and maybe the home run stuff, you leave it to the two leaders. But what is essential here is that the president, Kim Jong-un, develop a personal chemistry. I've urged the president publicly, you know, he doesn't listen to me, but publicly, to take Kim Jong-un aside. You make deals with the North Koreans on the sidelines, informally, not across the negotiating table. They're going to have their venting, their talking points. We'll do the same. It's building trust, a personal relationship that will lead to a negotiation process. It's not going to be a one big deal at one summit. It's going to take years. It's going to take several summits. And this is why I think it's essential that they build a personal trust.
You've visited North Korea several times. You've been on negotiations before. Is there any generalization to be made about a North Korean leadership negotiating style? Is there anything that we, or more importantly, President Trump, should know going into this?
Yes. First, they don't negotiate the way we do. They don't think like us. They don't believe in quid pro quos because they feel they have a divine right emanating from their cult of personality, their leaders, Kim Jong-un, Kim Jong-un's father and grandfather. So they don't think they are wrong. They don't like to make concessions. They like to find ways to show that they're prepared, they're relentless. They don't make agreements in the negotiating table. They like to get some trust built, and they like to make deals informally. This is why I think it's important that in Singapore, the logistical people that are there find ways to get meals of the two leaders together, let them walk together in Singapore, let them informally meet. But let Pompeo take the lead on what we want to achieve, which, yes, it's total denuclearization by North Korea, but that's not going to happen. But there can be a lot of good segments of denuclearization and missile activity and conventional weapons and, you know, hitting the United States and Japan and North Korea, our allies, protecting our troops, getting the remains from our soldiers from the Korean War, from the North Koreans. There's a lot of good that could happen to the summit. So I think the administration should not get greedy and stop saying total irreversible denuclearization. That's a good goal, but it's not going to happen at one summit.
How far could the North Koreans go to satisfy President Trump, do you think? If they're not, they're obviously, if you're saying they're not going to give up their nuclear program entirely, at least not immediately, how does President Trump get a win out of this?
By sticking to what he said informally the other day, a phased denuclearization. And then how do you define denuclearization? You know, the North Koreans see it as freezing their weapons, curbing their use. We need to find a middle ground where they maybe commit long range to total denuclearization, but with inspections, full inspections, unfettered inspections, timelines, by when are you going to do this? You got to show us your inventory. There's just a lot of things that are really not being discussed that could come good out of the summit. No nuclear exports. No missile exports to any other countries. Find ways to stop chemical weapons going into Syria. No sales of nuclear materials to rogue countries, to international outlaws. There's just a lot that could be good coming out of the summit. But, you know, let's remember one thing. In a negotiation, both sides have to give, or both sides have to find common ground. And I can tell you that North Koreans are going to want an awful lot. And I think what they want is private sector assistance, economic assistance, sanctions lifted. They're going to want a peace treaty with South Korea and the United States. They're going to want an assurance that we won't have regime change. They'll want sanctions lifted from China. They're going to want a lot. So it's not going to be the U.S. gets everything it wants. We're going to have to find ways that the United States, Japan, China, and South Korea, we're going to have to come up with something that they want.
Governor Bill Richardson, thanks for taking a few minutes today.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris.
This is Judge Napolitano with your Fox News commentary coming up.
I don't know about you. I was hoping for flying cars by now.
Roads? Where we're going, we don't need roads.
But while we wait, we do have electric cars. The Chevy Bolt, the Nissan Leaf, BMW, Mercedes, and Ford have models. And of course, there's Tesla.
So I'm in an electric car. I'm in a Tesla.
And this is a Model what?
S.
This is a Model S. Okay.
75.
This, we just use this.
Push it down one more time. Now it's in drive.
So I've heard that this is a very quiet vehicle.
That's correct.
It is very, very quiet. When you take your foot off the accelerator, it really almost feels like you're doing a small brake.
It's called regressive braking.
Regenerative braking.
Regenerative braking.
Yeah.
I talked to Hooman Hamadi and Eitan Konstein, both Tesla owners, while driving Eitan's Tesla in Los Angeles, about what more and more Americans want. A new AAA study says 20% of Americans want their next car to be electric. There are some concerns, though. For example, as Tesla gears up for fully autonomous cars, they have a feature in existing cars called autopilot.
You get into the lanes, and you have to use your left hand, and there's pull. There's a stock, and you pull it twice toward you. Pull it twice toward you. Yeah, and so now you're an autopilot. If you let go of the wheel, it'll drive itself. You see, there's a car stopped in front of you. It's going to brake itself. You don't have to touch it. And you can see the car in front of you, and you can also see these little fluid lines indicating.
Oh my gosh,
you know,
it feels that the car is moving out of the way.
Moving, and then it's going to continue on its way.
Oh my God, that's wild.
Isn't that incredible?
Oh my gosh.
And you can
it slowed itself and then slowly accelerated as a car in front of me parallel parked and moved out of my way.
There you go.
Just
and then you can tap that. Okay, now it's good. Just let it drive. You have to rest your hands at the bottom of the wheel so that you're ready to take over at any point. But as this car slows down,
oh my
gosh.
Right? It's so weird to give up control.
Yeah. Now, Tesla you're not giving up control. You're maintaining control, but you're allowing this to assist you. So it's solely a driver assistance feature.
But the role autopilot's played in some recent accidents is under investigation, including in Utah, where according to police, the car sped up before slamming into the back of a fire truck on a highway. The woman driving said she'd been looking at her phone at the time. Just this week, police in Laguna Beach, California, said a Tesla in autopilot slammed into a parked police car, totaling it. The officer on scene asked, "Why do these vehicles keep doing that?" Some consumer groups are concerned.
It's not much more than a combination of lane keeping, adaptive cruise control, and automatic emergency braking. But they call it autopilot. The name itself leads you to believe that the thing can drive itself.
John Simpson with Consumer Watchdog says they've filed a complaint against Tesla with the FTC.
And you've got the chairman of the company, you know, running around making videos with his hands waving out the window, showing that the hands don't need to be on the steering wheel. And they've got another one of their videos saying, oh, there's a person behind the wheel, not because he's doing anything, it's because he's required to be there by law. They kind of create this perception, I think, in many reasonable people's minds that these things can drive themselves, when in fact, if you read the fine print of some of the manuals, they say, oh, you got to pay attention all the time.
Tesla CEO Elon Musk has said it's not meant to be a self-driving car. Autopilot means your hands need to be on the wheel. Last week, Tesla settled a class action lawsuit, though, with owners of Model S and Model X vehicles. The car owners had said the assisted driving autopilot system was essentially unusable and demonstrably dangerous. Tesla said what had happened was they had to wait longer than they expected for the second version of autopilot to even be activated. And since rolling it out in 2016, they've continued to provide software updates that they say improved things. Autopilot, though, was also being used before a fatal crash in Mountain View, California this year. The car caught fire and rose another concern about something many electric cars rely on. Lithium-ion batteries.
A battery fire that would smolder for hours and reignite even days later.
The battery began to overheat, even though we had already cooled the battery, and it continued to reignite.
So it continued to catch fire?
Yes.
Fox affiliate KTVU caught up with the Mountain View fire chief, Juan Diaz, who said the car's battery reignited 6 days later while in a tow yard.
It's very rare that they catch on fire.
Andrew Clock is with the National Fire Protection Association's Emerging Technology Program.
If that happens, we instruct firefighters on how to handle that situation. It's a little bit different than internal combustion engines, but an internal combustion engine creates a major, major fire event with any vehicle. And the way you handle that kind of fire and the way you handle a lithium-ion battery fire is very similar. However, you need to cool the chassis of the battery, the batteries are usually encased in steel, and they can't get the water directly on the batteries, so they need to just cool the case and in order to stop the propagation of the fire from cell to cell. So you need to keep the water on a certain part of the case for a longer period of time than you would with an internal combustion engine vehicle.
Does any part of you feel more comfortable with the safety of an electric vehicle as opposed to a combustible engine?
I would say if a firefighter is trained properly, then they would feel comfortable in both situations equally.
Okay.
The challenge is training, and that's why 9 years ago NFPA set up a training program. We have an online training program that anyone in the fire service can take for free.
In your mind, is there really a comparison that you would make between the two modes of transportation, or is one safer in your mind than another?
Not at all. I think they're equally safe. I think you have, according to NFPA statistics, there's an internal combustion engine fire every 2 minutes in the United States. So you don't hear about those, and some are, you know, small, and some can be extremely volatile fires. However, when an electric vehicle catches fire, it's probably going to make the news this evening.
Humon Hamadi, who owns a Tesla Model X, says he feels safer in an electric car.
Every internal combustion engine, or ICE car as they're called, is filled with gallons and gallons and gallons of a very explosive fluid, namely called gasoline. And that gasoline is located right in the back of your car, exactly where it would be if you got rear-ended. And cars catch on fire and explode all the time that have gasoline on board. The chance of a fire with a lithium-ion battery in an electric car is exceptionally low. The only times that lithium-ion batteries in Teslas have caught on fire is when it's been an extremely severe accident. A traditional accident shouldn't cause a fire in those batteries. And when they have occurred, they put them out. And they're not going to be explosive because there isn't any combustible explosives. It's just the battery chemicals, which will eventually burn themselves out. So, yes, there are all these fears and people talk about it, but mostly because it's an unknown. And they completely neglect the fact that gasoline is far more combustible than anything that's any battery in any of these cars.
More people may say they want an electric vehicle, but Hamadi and Eitan Constein aren't necessarily convinced that they're going to rule the roads.
Without an infrastructure, I don't think it will work. I think the other car companies are still set in their ways that they produce a hard good. They haven't moved and transitioned to the point that they realize they have to be a software company. I'm sure that Porsche and all these other companies have technological prowess, but without building the overall infrastructure, I don't see how it's going to become mainstream.
Infrastructure like?
Superchargers every single place.
Constein says Tesla charging stations have allowed him to go from L.A. to San Francisco or Las Vegas. Hamadi explains further.
But if you have a non-Tesla vehicle, you cannot use those Tesla superchargers. You have to go to regular, slow car charging stations. Now, that said, Volkswagen, as part of its settlement for fudging with the admissions data, agreed to build heavily in California as well as throughout the rest of the nation something that's similar to Tesla superchargers, except with a much lower state of charge and with much lower density. So once electric cars proliferate, you're going to have to be waiting potentially hours on end to get access to one of these high-speed charger stations. But with Teslas, they're ubiquitous.
Michael Farkas, the founder of Blink Charging, is banking on them being very wrong. They manufacture charging station hardware and then sell the electricity. They install the hardware on properties, everywhere from shopping malls to office buildings to apartment complexes.
We believe that people are going to charge their cars where they're standing still. Most people today, the average driver, the average car owner, their car stays dormant roughly 90% of the day. So we're looking at the EV owner not having to drive to a gas station, but when he's at home, he'll be charging. When he's at the office, he'll be charging. When they're shopping at a shopping mall, you'll be able to charge. Again, obviously, along long-distance travel routes, you will have gas station-type environments with multiple superchargers that will allow for longer-distance traveling. But we believe, for the most part, most people will charge at home.
Depending on the battery and the vehicle, the distance an electric car can travel varies from 70 to more than 300 miles before needing to recharge.
Download Living the Bream with Shannon Bream.
I don't think as long as Donald Trump is the president, anything's going to slow down. We have material and stories and excitement every single day.
Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcast.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Judge Andrew Napolitano.
What's on your mind?
When Rudy Giuliani last weekend said that the Bob Mueller investigation of Russian involvement with the Trump campaign was rigged and was illegitimate, did he really mean that? I don't think so. I think he's too smart to have said what he knows is an untruth. When you call an investigation rigged, you mean the outcome has been predetermined. You mean it's not been fair. Well, it's not the duty of the prosecutors to be fair. And Giuliani, one of the great prosecutors in the history of New York City, knows that. Prosecutors pick a target they think is probably guilty and then look for enough evidence to indict and try that target. They leave fairness up to judges and juries. And former mayor and former U.S. Attorney Giuliani knows that. But why would he have said Bob Mueller is unfair, the investigation is rigged, and it's illegitimate? Because in addition to serving as the president's lawyer, he's also serving as the president's PR person, trying to undermine public credibility in the Mueller investigation. Is it legitimate? Of course it's legitimate. It's done. The investigation came about pursuant to a rule in the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, which Congress approved of. Mueller was appointed by Rod Rosenstein, the number two person in the Department of Justice, who himself was appointed by President Trump. Six different federal judges have ratified the Mueller investigation. The president himself even ratified a portion of the Mueller investigation when he imposed sanctions on the Russian intelligence agents whom Mueller indicted for meddling in the 2016 presidential campaign. So they both know what they mean when they use language like rigged and legitimate. They don't mean it literally. They don't mean it legally. They mean politically. They want you to look the other way. I'm Judge Andrew Napolitano.
You have been listening to the Fox News Rundown. Stay up to date by subscribing to Fox News Radio's hourly newscast at foxnewspodcasts.com. And for up-to-the-minute news, visit foxnews.com.